Welcome to another episode of GEQ Speaks, your go-to platform for insightful conversations, captivating stories, and thought-provoking discussions. GEQ is a series of experiences, and we're just making sense of that as we go along. That is what we're doing here, one conversation at a time. So sit back, relax, and let's dive into our episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of GEQ Speaks. My name is Rimas Al-Hawari, class of 2026, and I'll be the host for today's episode. Today, it is with great pleasure that I'm joined by Iman Tawfiq, a GEQ alumni who is today the Student Development Coordinator and who is foreseeing the Zones of Peace, Zones of Conflict program at GEQ.
Thank you, Rimas, for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm also joined by Ayat Bouhajib from the IPOL class of 2024. Hello, Ayat.
Hi, Rimas. Thank you for having me today.
I'm happy you're here. And we have Riwash Katwuda, who's from IECO class 2025, who will be sharing his experience today on the program.
Hi, Rimas. Thank you for having me as well.
Thank you for being here. So before we delve into our discussion, I would like to explain to our listeners the concept of this program and its purpose at GEQ. So since 2008, Georgetown University in Qatar has been taking students to zones of ethnic, political, social, and religious conflict, with the goal of better understanding both the causes of conflict and the difficult process of reconciliation. This program is known as Zones of Conflict, Zones of Peace, which is also known as Zones. So each semester, a faculty member teaches a 6+1 weeks program, which is a 3-credit course, on a topic that they have chosen. So students then travel with the faculty member and staff from the Office of Student Development to the country of study. Since COVID-19, there has been 3 trips at GEQ under this program, first to Nepal, in which Riwash participated in, then to South Africa, in which Ayat took part in, and finally to Finland and Estonia, in which I participated in myself. So now that our listeners have a better understanding of the program, I would like to kickstart discussion with Iman. As a student development coordinator, and I would say the behind-the-scenes director of this program, what really goes behind the curtain when it comes to organizing this program? So maybe explain the basis or criteria of choosing a particular country, and maybe walk us a little bit through the program, starting with the application process, to the trip itself, and finally the student projects conducted.
Sure. So to kick off, a faculty member would usually express their interest in a particular region, a conflict, or an area of peace to Dean Hill. He would ultimately make the final decision based on where we can go. We take safety concerns into consideration. We take the proximity of the country, the feasibility of the location, and everything. Once that's decided, we roll out the applications, and we do this deliberately where there's an anonymous component with the academic essay. We split the application into the academic essay and the personal statement. So the academic essay is anonymously read by the faculty member at Dean Hill usually. I read all the applications before they get it, and we make sure that there's no identifying information. This way we see how interested a student is in a particular conflict or a particular region, because it would depend on how much research and interest they've put into that whole process. So then we gather the scores together, we create a good pool of students, we deliberately make sure that there's a mix of people who are interested in a variety of things, just because that adds to the contributions at the end, especially when we have our reflections and our debriefs. Once we roll out the applications and before the classes start, we usually go on what we call is a pre-trip. And at this point, I would have sat down with the faculty member, we hash out the details of where we want to go, what we should be doing, who we should ideally be meeting, actors, academics, politicians, all of that. So we know what to do when we hit the ground. And then we go into these meetings. We have easily over 10 to 20 meetings in a week, just because it's our time to decide what's good, what's not good, what's relevant to the class. And during this, we pick everything from the hotels to the restaurants to the locations that we want to have debriefs in, to museums that are ideal, to cultural components. We make sure that there's a good, healthy mix for the students within a week. And then we come back, and then the classes, like you said, are a 6+1 model. So 6+1 refers to 6 weeks of classes and the 1 week of intense experiential learning when we're on the ground in that particular country. And a nice touch that we do to this is, instead of a traditional class paper or an exam at the end of it, students are usually put into groups or sometimes individually, and then they have to create a multimedia project. And this multimedia project allows them to go into the group's interest in what they want to touch. So we've had people do cultural elements. We've had people touch up on political activists that they met and anything that the students really take to their liking while they're on the trip. And that's the final outcome of it. So they get to see like a visual exhibition, essentially, of the whole process.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. I might want to have a follow-up question on that. I was interested to know, is there a competition between faculty members to get on the Zones program?
That would be a Dean Hill question, but usually they just express what they want to, what their expertise is and what they would like to teach in, and then we just see if it's a feasible thing. Or usually there's like a list of proposed regions of conflict that they want to study, and then depending on the time, Dean Hill will usually pick one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. A lot goes behind the scenes, I see.
A lot of
it. So now let's just shift the conversation a little bit to those who have been on these programs that Iman has organized herself. So first, we'll start with Riwaj. He was on the first post-COVID-19 trip. So let's hear about the course, the application process. Like, how did you get in the program, you think? Like, what made you successful in that? And how did you successfully navigate through this?
I think for me, like, I had no idea about Zones of Conflict and Zones of Peace, because, like, when I came in, there was no such program. After my sophomore fall, 2022. I think that semester it was a bit early. Like, our semester ended in November, and the applications were open right after our semester ended, and it was due on December 2nd. I actually remember this for some reason. So I was actually planning to go to Ireland during winter break to meet my sister, and I had gotten a lot of books from the library just to write for the application. So I went to Ireland. I met my sister, and then I started writing. Like, I started 1 week early. I started researching about what was going on in Nepal regarding migration, because I'm from Nepal and I was really, really interested in that. And I really wanted to get into the program just so I can study something that I've not been able to study hands-on and through the lens of someone else, of not being a Nepali. That's how I started. That's how I wrote my application, as someone who is really interested in migration in Nepal, not just as a Nepali, but about the whole process in South Asia and in the subcontinent. And I think that's, and even my personal statement, I wrote about how migration and the war in Nepal has affected my family and how much it means for me to go to the program. So I think that that's how I navigated the program. What was the other question? I forgot, sorry.
It was just about, like, how did you success? Like, do you think that your essay when you submitted it was worth being accepted into the program?
I think it was, because I spent a really a lot of time in it. Like, I think you're only supposed to cite like two or three sources in academic
went
essay
above and beyond.
And I think I cited like 11 sources, because I read so many papers, like I read so many journals, like even when we started the class there were so many papers I'd already read, like just to write that academic essay. Mm-hmm. So I really went above and beyond for the for the essay, and I think that made me got in. Like, I was really, 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 really prepared.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how your identity connects with the trip itself, and how you were like, you were able to go on the trip and then know more about your own country through the lens of maybe foreigners.
Yeah, like, that was the first time, like, because I'm from Kathmandu, and I was in Kathmandu for 1 week, and I didn't really go home. I was in a hotel. That will never happen. Like, if I'm in Kathmandu, of course I'm going to go to my home, right? So, like, it was a really a strange experience for me, like, being in Kathmandu, not being with my family, being with foreigners, you know, walking around the streets of Kathmandu with completely like 21 foreigners.
Were you their guide? Like, did they use you for guidance?
I was.
For translation purposes?
For translation purposes. Like, whenever they were buying something, I was the one to go and bargain on behalf of them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that was it. Yeah.
That was a full-on experience.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll get back to the details of this trip, but I also like to hear from Ayat. So Ayat, you went to South Africa.
Yeah.
Can you hear more about your experience? You went during the fall semester of 2023.
Yeah. So actually, when I came to Georgetown, I heard about the trip, actually, that was canceled before COVID, which was supposed to be Tanzania, pretty sure. So I already had some background knowledge, like, about the trip itself. The first one to Nepal, to be honest, I was a little bit overwhelmed with my work personally. That's why I didn't apply, not that I was not interested. But specifically when the topic of South Africa came on, I really wanted to go. Just because I've taken, this is like a little bit not related, but also related. I took European history with Professor Kola, and my final paper was about the Nuremberg trials. So that's when I was like more interested in retributive versus restorative justice. And I was like, it's something that I've always wanted to see how different countries approached it. So when the South Africa trip came on, and And the theme was post-apartheid and kind of studying how the community was healing after the apartheid regime. I was very interested. I also did a lot of research. So since the trip was in the fall, the application came out mid-July, something around that. And it was due at the beginning of classes. And I remember I started very early, like preparing for it. I was in Berlin visiting my brother, so a similar story. And I was actually going to museums, like seeing the Nazi regime, like kind of how they went around afterwards with the Nuremberg trials, with a lot of the things of how like they approached it. Because I feel like it's such a different approach in the sense that in Germany you cannot say Nazi. The word is like very like taboo. Nobody speaks about it. It's like a black hole in their history that they just want to move on from, right? Mm-hmm. So I was very interested. So I was like, I visited a couple of museums, and then I was like, and then I went to the library, and I was like locked up there for a good like 2-3 days writing my essay. I watched a lot of videos on like the trials of the Truth and Dignity Commission, Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Sorry, the Dignity one was in Tunisia.
Okay,
it's my thesis coming back to me. But yeah, I watched a lot of videos and trying to get a feel of their approach to justice afterwards before I write my academic essay, because I was very interested in it, but I wanted to get a sense of like, the question was about how efficient was it? Obviously, I didn't know because I didn't go on the ground yet, but I read a few papers, I watched the trials, and like I got a sense of like I was personally invested in this. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's how my academic essay went around. I also cited like around like 15 sources, academic sources, because wow. I was reading a lot. But it's just, I got very invested in it. For the personal one, the personal essay, I felt like that was my space to say why I'm interested in it. And it was like the prompt was to choose one of the qualities of self-motivation, inquisitiveness, and then open-mindedness and flexibility. I chose open-mindedness because I couldn't fathom the idea of a community going back to being one after what had just happened. So I felt like I needed to be open-minded going to South Africa. So I just challenged myself with that. And I actually, my personal essay was about a conversation I had with a German Zionist on that trip. When I was writing my application, I was like, what am I going to write about? And then this like discussion came on, and it was like a perfect segue into my application, because I had a very insightful conversation where I had to really practice my open-mindedness and my ability to understand someone else's point of view. And I felt like that was so crucial when going to South Africa, because we saw both sides. So yeah, that was my personal essay. But I would just say it takes a lot of research, and they have to see that you're really, really, really interested in it, whether personally, like if you have a personal connection like Rivaj does, or whether you're interested in it just because you want to understand more about the region.
So you guys, like, you went above and beyond for your application process. Now I'm too shy to share my application process. So for me, I applied for the South Africa trip. Yeah, and I got rejected.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, why did I get rejected? I really wanted to go, especially in the light of, like, October 7th. I feel like I was like, I'm missing out. Like, they're doing so much, and they're learning so much. And even the topic itself was very interesting. But then when the application came out in December, I was like, even seeing like the prompt for, I mean, the course name, it's titled History, Identity and Security in Post-Soviet Eastern Europe. And it's offered by Professor Kola. So looking at the title, I was like, this is not my territory. Like, I don't know anything about this. Yeah. I've never learned anything about this. I have no idea what's going on. And like being a Jordanian, knowing that there will be like people from post-Soviet states on the trip, I was very intimidated. Yeah. But I was like, you know what? Shoot your shot. Like, just do the application. Stop overthinking as if you just got in.
Yeah.
So I started working on the essay. I was like, what am I? Because the essay for the trip was like, what post-Soviet territories and their relationship with the Russian bear.
Yeah.
And the idea of like conflict and peace in these territories. So I was like, what is a territory that I would choose, or a country that I would choose that would relate to that? And I couldn't like resonate with anything that from like the regions. I was like, okay, people will write about Kazakhstan. People will write about Ukraine. And I don't know enough, like I don't know that much, and I can't know in a few days that like my essay will be that thorough. So I thought about writing about Chechnya, which is a territory in Russia that is it's still under Russia, but it has a Muslim population that is, I would say, a minority, and it's being very discriminated against by the Russian regime. For me, that was something I resonated with because it resonated with my identity. So I would say, like, even if the prompt doesn't necessarily connect to you, try to find maybe a loophole for you to jump in and try to write your essay about that. For the personal statement, it was very like vague, like just a conversation I had with a professor, like, and how that prompted my interest in learning. So the trip was to Finland and Estonia. That was the trip that I went on, and I'm still taking the course, so I'm not done. But I just thought I'd jump in and share my experience on zones. So I'll go back to Iman. So Iman, out of each of these programs, what was the hardest program you have worked on organizing, and what was the program you really enjoyed working on and coordinating?
I can't pick a favorite because I think all three countries had such. I think all three countries had like such a unique thing to offer that it was just different. Like the experiences we had organizing it in Nepal versus South Africa, and then going to Finland and Estonia, they're just not comparable for me because we saw different response rates. Like I feel like in Nepal, given the way things had happened, people were a little bit more open about speaking about the things that had happened. We didn't have as hard of a time reaching out to like government entities or academics. South Africa, we saw a little bit more of a reservation. There's still a lot of like hurt that you can see within the community. So it was difficult for people to want to meet a diverse group of students coming all the way from Qatar, and then to talk about this was shaky for some. Some were open to it, as Ayat would have seen. Our tour guides were more than happy to speak about it. They took us through the areas that they were living in and stuff. But interestingly, Estonia was actually one of the hardest places for us to try and meet more dignitaries and officials. I think given the current situation in Ukraine, given their reserved culture by nature, that it was just very hard for us to be able to approach them. And you would have seen this on the trip as well, that we had quite a few last minute cancellations. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something Professor Kola had also used in the moment to be like, that's a teaching session and teaching moment for everyone there. Because it's, you see how they approach these situations differently, and they're not willing to speak to a bunch of university students about it. Tells you a lot about the way that they interact with these regions and these conflict zones. So I can't pick a favorite. I can't also say that one is particularly hard. I think there've been difficult elements to each thing. Sometimes it's about like logistically getting things through, or like, you know, getting people to actually be willing to speak to a group. But no, nothing very hard per se, but it's just these little elements here and there that we always encounter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you can't tell us about the hardest trip, but I want to know what's the most one that you enjoyed going on. Personally, as Iman.
I think Nepal for me was the most exciting, to be honest, because as a South Asian, I would say that Nepal was not what I was expecting it to be, because there's just not a lot written about it. And it's such a shame, right? It's like it's a little hidden gem out there. You see a lot about South Africa and how beautiful Cape Town is, and you see a lot about Finland and Estonia. And I think Nepal for me in that way was a very exciting one because it was just different. It wasn't something you could just Google and there was like a top 10 best list to do things. It was things we were finding out on the ground. We had local help like Rewaj and other students around it. So I think for me, that was the most exciting part. Like it was just, it was a very unexpected thing that at every corner. So that made it interesting. Mm-hmm. The others were great, just to reiterate.
I'm not disappointed at all.
I mean, we're glad we had you on all the trips. Yeah. Yeah, you've been a great company. So Rewaj, as part of the Nepal trip, I want to know, how was the expectations versus reality for you? As Iman said, like you were discovering things along the way. So during the 1 week trip, what were the things that really struck you and contributed the most to your understanding of the course?
I think when we talk about our Nepal trip, our flight to Nepal was the first thing we talk about. So it was a 4.5 hour flight, and then we're about to land, and then it was a false landing. So we're just roaming around the skies of Nepal for the next 3 hours.
Yep.
For the next 3 hours, and everyone was scared and everyone was asking me questions like, has this happened before? I was like, nope, this is the first time. Wow. This is the first time. And the pilot was like, okay, we might have to go to like India and then land there because like we're running out of fuel.
I never heard about this.
Cause, like,
me neither.
Because the thing is, like, in Kathmandu, the wind was really, really high and the plane just couldn't land. So I think after 7 hours of just sitting in the plane waiting for it to land, we landed at around, we're supposed to land at 4, we landed at 7. And then we went outside. My parents were there actually at the airport and they welcomed all of us. So that was really, really awesome. Overall in Nepal, so after that we went to the hotel and I don't know how to explain because I was like, you know, I was telling people like this is the best place, this is the best restaurant, this is what we'll be doing and stuff like that. And everyone was really, really, really excited. And I was really like, you know, I was like, okay, I'll show them this, I'll make them do this, I'll make them eat this. so that was really fun. And like starting next day, we started meeting people and about the like the war in Nepal, it started in 1996, it ended in 2006. But the thing is, like when we were studying in school, our curriculum, it hadn't been updated since 2003. So I had never studied about it, like, officially in my school or anywhere. So, like, all I've known about the war was through my parents or, like, through some YouTube videos I've watched while growing up. So actually learning about the war and how it had affected a lot of people, how it had affected even my family somehow, and, like, the memories of the war, like, how we traveled, like, every time we used to travel out of Kathmandu, there would be, like, pit stops. The police would come in, check all our bags and stuff like that. And now when I'm learning about the war through an academic setting, like, everything made sense. Like, everything started falling into places. So that was something really, like, enlightening for me in that sense. Like, I knew about the war. Maybe I knew about the war more than anyone else in the class. But still, like, that was something I never thought about it that way. Also, like, when you see people who have been affected by the war, other Nepalis, you're like, I've been so distant from it. Like, I actually kind of knew about my privilege and how, like, living in Kathmandu my entire life, I didn't really have, like, was directly impacted by the war. We're just, like, you know, far away from the action. And it also made sense why the war happened, like, why the war was needed for our country and what it changed and how it changed, why the king is no more, the monarchy, like, right at the end of the war, the monarchy in Nepal ended, the 300-year-long monarch ended in 2008, and it was all due to the war. So everything started making sense to me, and when you start talking to people and what they have done in the field and how they are helping people, like, especially in the face of transitional justice and, like, post-reconciliation, and you feel like, you know, I have to do something, like, this is my country, I have to do something, this is my identity, I have to, like, go work for it. Mm-hmm. So that was something really amazing, like, you know, self-realization that came out of this trip. And it was really, really fun as well. So before going to the trip, I only knew, like, 4 people, like, 2 of the Nepalis and 2 other people. But after the end of the trip, like, I made so many friends, like, and still all of them are such close friends right now. Mm-hmm. Like, Nepal for 1 week, that was the best experience in Nepal I've ever had, although I lived in Nepal for 20 years.
Wow, okay. Yeah. Georgetown has really stepped up their game. Yeah. Okay, interesting. Actually, the idea of, like, connecting with people in the group is something I also resonate with. I feel like I got closer to people I would have never gotten close to if I was just on campus. I also want to know about your experience. Mm-hmm. So I know you went to South Africa during such difficult times. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, like, what was, I'm pretty sure it's your first experience in South Africa.
Yeah.
So how was the atmosphere, the different cities that you visited, and the experience altogether?
I loved South Africa. I never thought I would be going there, to be honest, just because it's so far. And to travel from Tunisia, there's no direct flights. So it takes you 22 hours to get to South Africa with all, like, the layovers. So it was like, I didn't think I would ever be there, but I always wanted to go because I have a lot of friends from ALA. And even a few Tunisians, I went to ALA, so they've always told me how beautiful it is. So I was very excited to go. Our flight was, now that I'm seeing, it's like so much more peaceful. It was around 10 hours. Mm-hmm. So it was quite long. But I mean, the experience was wonderful. We went in October. We went on the 5th. We left on the 5th. So by the time we landed and got settled in, it was October 6th. The first day was quite, like, chill. We were, like, visiting some museums. We went to Cape Town first, and then we took a flight, and we went to Joburg, and from Joburg, we drove to Pretoria. Wow. So we visited 3 kind of cities, too. But I'll start with the reason why we visited the 2 cities before I go into what was happening at the same time. But the reason why is because, and this is very funny, because when we were all reflecting on the trip, we were like, the plane to Cape Town was mostly white people, and the plane from Joburg was a lot of black people. And this is because there's, when we think of, like, post-apartheid regime, we were studying, obviously, on the ground, how people, Cape Town was mostly a white Dutch place. And a lot of black people or colored people in general, whether they were Asian, whether they were mixed, whether they were black, they were kicked out, expelled from Cape Town and its areas to different other places like District 6, just a little farther away from Cape Town, right? Most of the black population and colored population is focused in Johannesburg. So going to the 2 cities was actually like, I was like, in my head, I was like, oh, we're going to 2 cities. It's so much fun. No, but it had a lot of meaning behind it, because you can see the disparity between the 2 cities. Cape Town was very bougie, very a lot of yachts in the port, beautiful, gorgeous. Like, Table Mountain was so beautiful. Like, it was a lot of nice scenery. And we met a lot of activists, a lot of people who were on the ground, and it was very nice to see. But then, like, you learn about, oh, like, the disparities between the populations and everything, but then you never really see it until we went to Johannesburg. And that's where Iman could even tell you, like, even the risks of us being in certain places was a lot higher. It was completely different. You could tell that the disparity between the two communities is still so deeply ingrained until today, like, especially the economic disparity, because most of the populations were living in very, how do you say it, like large neighborhoods with large populations. A lot of the people, you could see like a completely different scenery. As beautiful as Johannesburg is, it's just you can see the different scenery, and like from going to bougie Cape Town to going to Joburg, which you can see that there's a lot of economic difficulties in the town. And that struck me the most. Into like when I wrote my essay, I was quite pessimistic about the transitional justice of South Africa. Now I'd like, it was a little bit more confirmed because a lot of people are still asking for their rights, and you could genuinely see that. Besides, we felt like the people like had come to terms with it a little bit. At least our guides had, like, when they were talking about it, you could tell like they were talking about it a little bit distancing themselves, but it was like also like they can talk about it. It's not like most people weren't, and I'm sure that's like it's an exception because they were tour guides and they're used to talking about this. But seeing it was very different, seeing how maybe not successful it was. And we saw this even in the parliament when we went, and then they were like talking about the political parties and the inefficiencies of the government. But to go back to your question about being there in an interesting time, we obviously woke up to the shocking news on October 7th, and we had a few Palestinian students on the trip. So we were busy trying to figure out like whether their families are okay, trying to make sure we reach out to the people that we reach out to. Professor Abu Sharif was there for us. Like, it was a moment of like, just make sure everyone that you know is okay. Try to keep up with the news. I remember we'd get on the bus, Professor Abu Sharif would be like, hey, has anyone heard anything new? Any developments? Stuff like that. But now that, you know, and also the President De Joya's email was sent, and I remember us being like, breakfast, like at the buffet, everyone being like, oh my god, how dare he? And we were like all like debating how to go around responding to such a message. So it was very interesting times, but now reflecting on it, South Africa was like the right place to say it to be, as you said, because of their involvement in the ICJ case. I remember when we went to BoCap, it's this really beautiful like pastel colored neighborhood, and we saw just Palestinian flags, and I was just like, it was like such a heartwarming moment to see. And then in Johannesburg, actually, we were at one of the neighborhoods, and our tour guide was like telling us about his experience and his life. And then there was just a random South African man that walked by. He was like, free Palestine. Wow. And he was just screaming it. And not like any of us had kufis. Maybe some of us looked Arab. Like, I don't know what it was about it, but he was just like screaming it at us. And it was just like, it felt like it was, I'm sure if we were in Finland, for example, or anywhere else in the world, it would not have felt that connected, and you wouldn't think that because it was so early on, right? But it definitely feels like, I'm like, okay, I was in South Africa, now it's leading the case. So it's like, it feels like a lot of the people really cared because they understand the struggles. Mm-hmm. And even when we went to the parliament and then we talked to other government officials, to the ministry, the foreign affairs and stuff like that, we asked them a lot about Palestine. We did. We like really pushed them. We were like, what are you doing about Palestine? What is going to be your next move? Obviously, they couldn't tell us a lot, but they were quite responsive. They were like, we understand, we empathize, we want to do something. And clearly, we see that they have done something. So I'm very happy to have been at a time that it's a place where I could express first my opinion freely without feeling judged, but also to see the solidarity of the people there.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how like human struggle manifests in different places. And I think it's really interesting how South Africa took the ICJ case in comparison to other Arab countries that failed to do so. But anyways, I'll talk a little bit about my Finland and Estonia experience. Since I'm still taking the course, I can't really give anyone like a full-on review, but I'll say for the trip that I went on, we went to Finland, we arrived in Finland, and then we took the ferry to Estonia for 2 days, and then we went back to Finland, Helsinki, and then we stayed a little bit, and then we went to a very nice place called Hauko. I would say it's a resort where we stayed in cottages and enjoyed our time. So in Estonia, I would say like we met with a member of the parliament. She talked about like the relationship, her being a Russian, like of Russian heritage, or having Russian origin, and her being Estonian, her dual identity, in comparison to in the context of the Russian hate towards post-Soviet states, or I would say it's like the situation happening in Ukraine right now in the context of that, and how the anti-Russian sentiment is growing in Estonia and in Finland. And then we went to Finland. We stayed in Helsinki for a little bit. We met members of parliament. We also met like students in the University of Helsinki. We also met very interesting characters who were Russians, who were talking about like Russian propaganda as if it's the given thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It was very interesting. I would say something very sad happened. So we had a student who was Russian who couldn't go on the trip. And I think that really emphasized, like as Iman was saying earlier, the changes in the itinerary that were made, the student not being able to come. I think these were all like subtle indications of the relationship between mm-hmm. Russia and the post-Soviet states, and how these post-Soviet states are still not fully healed.
Yeah.
And how they will continue to fight against the Russian bear. So now moving back to Iman, I would say Iman, as part of the board working on this program, what advice would you give to students looking to take part in it? So I know you said that Dean Hill is the one reviewing the essays and the faculty also, but what is the criteria, do you feel like, when it comes to the application process, and what exactly are they looking for?
Like I mentioned, the application has two parts to it, the academic component, which obviously Dean Hill does with a faculty member, and then the personal statement, which I read with another fellow colleague in student development. Well, the academic part is a blind read because they don't know who's written it. They're purely going on interest and attention. So clearly we have overachievers here who've listed more than 10 sources. That kind of shows us that, you know, the students are really interested in the program and that they really are interested in this particular topic. And then when I look at the personal ones in particular, I try to make sure that there's a good group of people that are there. So it's what interests, what skills, what expertise do you bring in, and how would you contribute to a group? So when we're reading these essays and we deliberately put particular words in the prompt to see what students are going to pick up on, you need a mix of people who have that open-mindedness, the inclusivity, and all of that, because it shapes the way each session happens, whether it's at a museum, whether you're at a meeting, because you'll see it by the types of questions people ask. Or when we go into a debrief, it like they all bring in these different perspectives and it just enhances each other's experience. So there's very deliberate planning there. But again, we go based off of what the student has written on the application. So it's what you want to put out there, I think, is your best foot forward. And you always have to do that and find an angle that you think is unique. We've had people touch up on personal elements of their like undergraduate lives, high school, before, after. Then we just go with that and we see how the group would really come together. And I'm sure you guys would have noticed this even subtly during the debriefs. It brings out different things from different people. And that's very deliberately done so that everybody enjoys the whole experience.
Mm-hmm. I hope our listeners can get something out of that and try their best. Yes, be unique. Be yourself.
For sure.
So I have this question for both Ayat and Iwaj. Whoever wants to start can start mm-hmm. answering. So as I truly believe that the Zones program was designed to take us out of the classroom and into the real world to learn about issues concerning different regions globally, what is something you felt like you learned during the trip that you would have never learned from reading a book or being in a class, like being taught a lecture?
For me, it would be the experiences of the people who went through the war. I think it was on our fourth or the fifth day, we actually met with the Maoist leader, who was one of the leaders of the revolution, and all his people, and all the other people who were fighting, whether it be in the cultural wing of the Maoist or be it in the like military wing of the Maoist. So we're having conversations with them, and like some of them were like, I was just there so I could travel the world. Like I could go around and see, because I was just sitting at my house all day. I had nothing to do. Like my house was broken. Like we're really, really poor. So I just wanted to see the world. That's the only reason I joined the revolution. So I feel like it's not about the ideology or anything, like especially on a ground level, that people get involved in the revolution. Maybe the leaders of the revolution, they have certain ideologies, but for like common people, it's just about getting involved into something, like thinking that they're doing something for the greater good. And when I ask them, like, how do they feel about now, like what has the revolution achieved, and how has it changed them, and they're like there's a very popular saying in Nepal that the promised Nepal after the revolution, it was never delivered. And they told me the same thing. Like, they're like, we had a lot of hopes. We had like, you know, everything would be much more better. We'd be much more included in decision making, policy making, especially the so-called lower caste people in Nepal. But they're like, nothing really happened. Like the people who led the revolution, they went to the government. Now he's the prime minister of Nepal. but nothing really came out of it. Like, we're still the same. The people are still the same. The poverty level has not improved. Like, although, like, there are some, obviously, with the passage of time, there will be some improvements, but, like, it's still the same. Like, the promise with which the revolution had started, it really didn't get anywhere. So when you read about the revolution in the book, where, like, the successful revolution, which kicked the king, which kicked the 300-year-old monarch out of the country. But at the end of the day, nothing really changed. And it's just, like, the circle of power. And I think that it gave me, like, perspective on what people felt and how what people are going through in various parts of the Nepal. And how the revolution, although it changed a lot of things, at the end of the day, it really didn't change anything. Mm-hmm. So that was something that was really heart-wrenching for me, and something that I couldn't relate, but I related as well in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how you were able to, like, to grasp that after going on this trip, and, like, even though you've been living in Nepal for almost your whole life.
For me, like, I had no idea about the revolution. Like, mm-hmm. I said before, like, we never really studied about it. Mm-hmm. So we just heard stories from my parents or my grandparents, and they were not really involved in the ground level. So meeting people who were talking about their experiences was really, really an eye-opener. Mm-hmm. And it made me, like, appreciate the nuances of the revolution and, like, what happened and why so many people lost lives. And maybe at the end of the day, it was not worth it.
Mm-hmm. Ayat, can you tell us a little bit about what you thought you learned outside of the classroom?
I already said this to Robert in our film, so you guys should watch the film that's going to come out for South Africa. But I really, 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 really enjoyed being there on the ground, and I really felt the difference between studying something and reading about it versus going on the ground. And it made me question a lot of the things that I honestly read about before in many of my classes, because, as I mentioned, like, the disparity, for example, between Cape Town and Joburg, you can read about it, but you won't get the feel of how different it is until you actually go and see it. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between reading about, oh, the GDP of Cape Town is blah, blah, blah versus Joburg. And then you're like, okay, these are numbers, right? Okay, I can see, oh, wow, that's such a big difference. But, like, you can't see how the people are living, because this is especially, like, our topic of transitional justice and looking at restorative justice versus retributive justice. You really want to get a sense of whether this worked or not. And for me personally, it was like, also trying to see if this can be applied elsewhere. And I was mainly thinking of Palestine. I was like, what, especially in the light of October 7th, I was like, what next? Mm-hmm. If afterwards, can this model work for other people? Because it was replicated in Canada with the indigenous peoples. It was replicated in Tunisia with our torture of under the old regime and the corruption. And I was like, okay, can this work? Because this was taken as a model for a lot of people. And you could see in academic papers, they were like, we'll take the South African model because it worked so well. Despite it being, like, there is criticism in scholarly work, don't get me wrong, like, there is criticism. But, like, it's not the same as going and seeing it on the ground and talking to the people. Our tour guides were the highlight of our trip. Like, I still follow some of them on Instagram. They are so amazing. They are people who, and I think for them was very different, because usually they take tourists to tell them, oh, this is the best place to get this traditional food. Oh, this is the best place to do this, blah, blah, blah. But then for us, it was like they had to talk about deep wounds for their families, which was not that long ago. You know, mm-hmm. It was like late 1996. Mm-hmm. The apartheid regime fell. It was not that long ago. So these people were like
still old
enough to, like, have gone under through the regime and to have been wounded by it. So hearing their stories was honestly so enlightening. And not just them, even, like, the people when you go to the museums, their stories are very touching, and you could see how impacted they were by it. And it is quite sensitive asking them whether you think this worked or not. And, like, the opinions differ, whether, like, oh, yeah, this worked or it. But it brings such the human aspect of it, especially when it comes to studying zones of conflict and zones of peace, is very, very important. Mm-hmm. And you would not get it from reading a paper. But something else that I think we would have never been able to do, which was when we were in Pretoria, we met the king of the Khoisan people. And the Khoisan people are, like, the first peoples of South Africa, and just not South Africa as the country, but South Africa as a region, the continent. And these people are people who have been demanding their rights, want to be recognized as the first peoples, thus meaning that they get land, that they get recognition. There's, 11 languages recognized as official languages in South Africa, including sign language, but their language isn't. So it's, we went to Pretoria. We didn't mean to meet them. We went to Pretoria, and we were where there's the big Nelson Mandela statue, and they were there living
like the tribes lived before. You could see like they would grow their own plants there. It was like a tiny little space in a garden. And then they had these signs of telling their stories and their family stories of like the sexual assault that the women went through, mm-hmm. how their, I'm going to get a little bit more explicit here and trigger warning, but like their genitalia was transported to Europe to show these are how these aliens, animals look like. Hearing that was so heart-wrenching, but like you see the person talking about it. It's not reading about, and you can't find many sources about that because obviously the marginalized voices we know are not available. When you put a Google search in, you're not going to get their reports. You're not going to get pictures of them. You're going to get other things before you get to that. So it was a lot of human touch that was very much needed, especially when it comes to zones. I feel like you could read about the economic situation in, I don't know, the United States and be like, okay, mm-hmm. you don't need to, I don't know, it's not as necessary mm-hmm. to hear the human touch of it. But when it comes to justice and to conflict, I think it's like very necessary. That's why I would never approach a topic right now without actually having really tried my best to seek other sources that are not just the academic first two articles that come up when doing a paper.
Mm-hmm. I think something that you mentioned is about the conflict. I think that really resonates with even like Finland and Estonia yeah. and the post-Soviet states. I think prior to going on the trip, I was very detached. I was like, what is this region? I have nothing to do with yeah. it. Not my problem, not my issue. But then going there and hearing like even the members of the parliament like crying when they heard about the invasion of Ukraine yeah. or the human struggle in itself, something that really struck me. And I was like, we're all human at the end of the day. Even if you think you're detached from that region or it has nothing to do with you, we technically all in a way struggle in the same yeah. direction. Mm-hmm. Iman, I want to know from you as an alumni from the class of 2016. who studied at GUQ, and you obviously had friends who studied it on this campus. I know the Zones program existed since 2008, so you've experienced that. I'm pretty sure, I don't know if you have or you have not attended. Oh, you have not attended the Zones program. Okay, that was a head shake. So you can tell us a little bit if you have joined the Zones program. If not, why not? And any of your friends joined the Zones program?
Sure. So, unfortunately, I never did while I was an undergrad. So clearly, I'm getting my feel of it now. But I did have friends who did go on the trip. And, you know, it was always exploring different things. And I think that's one thing the Zones of Conflict, Zones of Peace program does really well, is that it goes into different areas of study, different locations, so that it touches up on everyone's interests. This was the first time we had done Eastern Europe in a while. South Asia, it was definitely new for us to go to Nepal. So it deliberately goes to different locations to give students that opportunity to be able to dive into what their levels of interest would be. In the past, it's done things like Germany and Poland. It's gone in Northern Ireland. It's done South Africa's been repeated. It did Muslims in America with the U.S. So
I heard Japan was a thing.
Yeah. And it did Japan. It did the atomic bombs in Japan. So it always picks up on different areas deliberately because the SFS is such a broad has such a broad range of students with different interests and stuff. So I don't think it's there's ever been any setbacks to it. I think it's just been on a constant development tool. And part of what's fun with working on it is that you have to keep up with the way the student interests and stuff are changing. Like South Africa, we didn't expect October 7th, obviously, to happen. So it was about, like, you know, how do you manage everything in that moment? So, no, I think the diversity of the student body has only enhanced this experience even further. So, no, and I hope it does continue to grow and develop, which it looks like it's going to be. So yep. It'll be fun.
I'm glad COVID-19 ended so we get to experience this again.
Too.
Yeah. So finally, I would like to conclude with one question from both yours and Ayat. Mm-hmm. Whoever wants to start first can start. What is something that you wish you did differently when you went on Zones? Maybe a different mindset or something simply forgot to take with you or something you wish you had. Maybe a different approach to dealing with the group you were part of.
I will start. I wish I brought warmer clothes. Oh my God. I got so sick. And it was just because I was not expecting the weather to be that cold, but also because we were on like hills and mountains like 90% of the time and the wind was really strong. So that's one thing I wish I had brought because I was really sick. But I think one thing I would say is, because this is an application process, don't be bummed if your friends don't get in. One, be grateful that you got in because it's getting very competitive. But two, try to appreciate because as you hear, like with Iman, like there's a lot of thought that goes behind this. It's not like choosing random people. It's not like, oh, you had such a good essay. But it's also a lot about the backgrounds, a lot about the interests, about what you can contribute. So don't judge it by the group that you see. Just like you mentioned, none of my close, quote unquote, friends went.
But I became so close to a lot of people that, as Arash said, like, we're still friends until today, and I'm very grateful for that. So one, don't be bummed because of that, because you honestly get to experience it. And honestly, sometimes you might need that to kind of detach a little bit from, like, the fun that you usually have to actually, like, building new relationships and trying to understand other people. An advice I would give is, for me personally, I didn't realize how much field work would go into this. Like, I knew we were going to be going to a lot of places, but I didn't know how enriching that would be and how valuable of a resource that is. So I went in with a topic, and then it completely changed to like 20,000 topics when I was there. Every time I would go somewhere, we went to a foundation about like the land redistribution. I was like, yes, I'm going to do land redistribution. We went to the parliament. I was like, yes, I'm going to do the political parties. We went to this. I was like, yes, I'm going to do this. So it's like, I feel like going in with one, an open mind, two, a few topics in mind, maybe touching on different things, and three, really trying to make the most out of the resources that you have, especially the people themselves. So I know I personally admired a lot of the final projects that use the people, like Lawrence worked on the tour guides and their background stories, and like, I wish I had done that. He knew that going in, like, he realized it on the trip. He wanted to do it before, but he realized it more on the trip, so he actually talked to the tour guys separately and got their point of view more on things that we might have not had the time to discuss. So I really like took the resources for granted in a way, because I could have asked a lot of people so many more questions that I had, even though we did have Ali's number still, who was very willing, one of our tour guys, to give us any help. But yeah, I would say like really make the most out of the resources that you have, not just for academic purposes, obviously, but I feel like it would allow you to have such a nice outcome of a product for the class, and also obviously for your own personal fulfillment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it would be something like I sort of interacted with other people in the class like before the trip. So we became friends only like, I think, Tuesday. Like we landed on Saturday, we became friends on Tuesday because I started singing Taylor Swift and everyone started singing Taylor Swift. And they're cool. So that's how we started becoming friends. And after that, only like we started hanging out as a group. Like it was, you know, 18, 19 of us hanging out together. So I wish that would have happened sooner, even like we had 3 weeks of classes. Like, you know, just make sure that you make, like, there'll always be amazing people around. Just make sure that you are friends with them before going to the trip and not only during the trip. So that would make your trip even more special. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then other than that, like, other than the learning aspect of it, have fun in the country, because, like, there's a very good chance that you might never visit that country again. Have fun, go interact with the local people, go to local restaurants, like not only fancy places around the country, because that will really, like, you know, give you the local feel about how people in that particular country live. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like if you get into zones, have fun. It will be one of the best 1 week of your life.
I think I also want to re-echo that. I think have fun, just enjoy the process. Enjoy your group, as everyone said. You'll make friends, I promise. You'll meet new people and they'll become friends maybe unexpectedly. I think also something, bear in mind that like you're moving as a group, so like be flexible and be mindful of the time. Iman knows I've been late so many times. I'm calling myself out here.
We would wait for like half an hour in the bus outside every
morning.
Okay,
not to that level. I'm not that bad. Not that bad. But yeah, I've caused some issues. Yeah.
Can I just add one thing? Mm-hmm. Prepare yourself to be very overwhelmed, mm-hmm. because we were from meeting to meeting, from museum to place, from like 8 a.m. to like 7 p.m. And that's a lot of learning to do. Take notes if you need, but also prepare yourself to be like, okay, I need to be ready to take all of this in and to be back to back to back. There's no slacking off. There's no being late. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of time to go to a nice restaurant and have a nice meal, to sit outside for a little bit. But you really have, as you said, to be considerate of the rest of the group and be ready to move and to engage and to make this worthy and to take all of the information in, because it's a lot. It's like 1 week, but we were busy back to back, like from morning to night. So
I think something also is for us as in our class, we're doing our projects in groups. So I would say meet with if you're doing it individually or with groups, just think about your project ahead of time so that you're not stressed after the trip and everything is done and you haven't collected enough material. Not like we're experiencing that right now. Prof. Circola should not listen to this. But I would say, yes, just prepare yourself ahead of time. Choose your topic. Really look into it. Don't jump like too much between topics, because then you'll confuse yourself. You don't have enough time to collect that much material. So go in with an idea and go for it and stop doubting yourself. And Iman, I almost forgot to ask you. I don't want people to hate me. So when we have guests on our podcast, we try to like ask for exclusive releases or reveals. I think it's fair to say that I'm not the only one who's curious to know about the next Zones trip destination. So maybe hints, if it's not finalized yet, maybe you can know about the options you're considering.
That's fair. I think there's going to be an exciting announcement to it. We might not hold a traditional Zones of Conflict, Zones of Peace in the fall, but it will be something a little different that looks into another country, but for not necessarily in the traditional like a conflict situation. So we're tentatively looking at going to Rwanda. With looking at the historical context of it, not touching up on the genocide necessarily, like that's not going to be the sole focus. So I think Rwanda is going to be the next destination. So keep your eye out on the emails. You'll find out
soon.
I'm
a senior. I'm graduating. I'm so mad.
Well, to our listeners, if you're looking to apply, then I think that would be an interesting destination to go to. And the aspect that you mentioned is not about the genocide. It's about a different lens.
Possibly focusing on the historical and cultural pieces before it. So,
That's very
you'll find out soon.
Okay, you'll find out. But I'm glad we got to know that on the podcast. So that's it for today. Thank you so much for joining us for today. I really appreciate your time, and I hope our listeners have enjoyed this conversation. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of GUQ Speaks. We hope you've gained valuable insights and inspirations from our conversation today. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to follow us on our Instagram page at GUQ_speaks, and be sure to leave a review on Spotify to show your support.